Welcome everybody back to another episode of Boosting Your Financial IQ. Today, I have a very special guest, probably because this guest is my brother. So welcome Nate Coffrin to the podcast.
Thanks, Dave. Happy to be here.
Well, okay. So Nate, the reason why I wanted you on the show is not only are you a very smart and handsome fellow, but also you have spent the majority of your career in real estate investment. And today we're going to be talking about the financial side of real estate investing. So I'm excited for this conversation that we have ahead. But before we get into it, maybe you could first start off by telling the audience a little bit about your background and how you ended up to where you are today.
Yeah. So I went to school for finance and accounting. And right out of college, I joined Ernst & Young, just like you, where I was in the audit group. But I only lasted about 9 months in audit before I realized that that was one of the most boring jobs I've ever been a part of, and I did not want to be in that any longer. And I quickly switched over to what I felt was a career that I really wanted to be a part of, and that was in real estate. So right after Ernst & Young, I joined a publicly traded REIT on the acquisition side of the business, and then after that, I worked for another publicly traded REIT, real estate private equity firm, and now we work for the fourth real estate investment firm I'm at right now, where we focus on multifamily investments along with industrial and other types of real estate assets. So I've been doing this for quite a while with a lot of different firms investing all across risk spectrum and a whole bunch of different property types.
Well, and I think this episode is going to be great because real estate is such an important part of one's portfolio. And we've talked about stocks and bonds and options and other financial instruments. So I'm excited to get into this. But before we jump into the side of real estate, let me ask you this, Nate. Who do you think is mom's favorite kid? Is it me or is it you? Or like, how do you digest that?
I'd probably say me just because I'm the most handsome, but you know, it's subjective, but that's what I would say.
Okay. It must be the hair because I'm bald and Nate got blessed with the hair. Yeah. So, okay. Well, that's great. Well, let's jump in here. So what are some ways to start investing in real estate? So if somebody's listening to the podcast and like, okay, great. I got some stocks. I got a 401k, you know, I have some other investments here and there, but real estate investing is interesting to me. So how do I go about getting started and what are some different ways to invest in real estate?
I would say the easiest and probably best way to start investing in real estate is to invest in a REIT, which is a real estate investment trust. A lot of REITs are publicly traded. You can buy and sell them just like you would any stock, private stock. And it's the easiest way to invest. You can invest as little as $5, $10. You can have a fractional share of a REIT. And what's great about a REIT is it's a very diversified portfolio of assets. And so you can invest in a REIT like Avalon Bay, which is one of the largest multifamily REITs in the country. By buying one share of that REIT, you're buying basically a part of hundreds and thousands of multifamily units all across the country in a whole bunch of different markets. So it's a lot less risky than just buying a single property because one property goes down within the REIT, it's not going to take the entire REIT down. So that's probably the easiest and recommended way for just the average investor to get into real estate would be to allocate just a portion of their assets into a REIT. So instead of putting 100% into stocks, maybe carve off 5 or 10% and put it into a REIT. That's probably the easiest way to get into it if someone wanted to get in right now.
So that's interesting. And I think that's good advice. I mean, what is a REIT exactly? I mean, you kind of explained from a high level, but how does it work? Who owns the REITs? Who's operating the REITs? What kind of properties do they typically invest in? How does that all work? Maybe you could walk us through that.
Yep. So like I said, REIT stands for Real Estate Investment Trust. And really, it's just a special organization that the U.S. tax code has allowed to be set up where think of a typical corporation where if you are, let's say, Procter & Gamble, and you earn income and you have to pay taxes on that income, and then let's say that you want to make a distribution to your shareholders, you then pay a distribution from your after-tax income to your shareholders. Your shareholders then gets that dividend, and then they have to pay tax on that dividend. So it's called double taxation. And it's a very inefficient way to get money to shareholders. So with a typical corporation, there is that double taxation issue. So dividends are great. Dividend stocks for many people work great for their portfolio, but you also have to realize that you're getting double taxed and it's not a very efficient use of capital. A REIT is actually the complete opposite, where with a REIT, a company is set up, they take in investors' money. So from people like me and you, typically they are publicly traded, and that's how they raise their capital through the public markets. They raise this money, they go out and they start buying a large portfolio of real estate. These REITs might be solely focused on one property type, like multifamily, or they could be very diversified and invest in multifamily, industrial, medical office, and so on. And so long as the REIT distributes 90% or more of their earnings back to the shareholders, the REIT does not pay taxes. So instead of being double taxed, with a REIT, you're only getting taxed once, and that's once you get the dividend. But that dividend is actually even further tax advantaged, and there's special tax treatment of those dividends. So it's even more tax efficient. So let's say if you were to get a 4.5% dividend from a corporation, the tax equivalent from a REIT would be about 6%. So there's quite a bit of tax advantage there.
So, and that's interesting. So to invest in a REIT, I mean, literally it's like investing in Netflix, ticker symbol NFLX, right? You could just go on, you could find a publicly traded REIT, you can add shares of that REIT to your portfolio, and bam, now you're invested in real estate.
Yep, that's exactly right. And what's great about it is you get the dividend. And so they'll pay out typically a quarterly or monthly dividend in the range of 2.5 to 6 or 7% annual dividend rate. And then plus you get the appreciation of that stock as well. So it's a good investment if you're just looking for a simple way to invest in real estate.
Yeah, and diversify your portfolio. So I know there's other ways to invest in real estate. There's like land speculation. You know, there's been all those shows on TV about property flipping. There's short-term rentals. You could do like small-scale residential rental properties, large-scale residential rental properties, commercial real estate investment trust, like we just talked about. There's all these different vehicles. Maybe talk a little bit about your career, like what you've been focused on, and any thoughts that you have on any of these other vehicles or other like avenues for investing in real estate.
So my career has been exclusively focused on large real estate transactions. And so with the different REITs I was at and the different privately held real estate investment companies, the average transaction size was going to be $50 million all the way up to $250 million for a single transaction. So very different profile than, you know, the typical investor like me or you who's looking to invest in real estate. But what I always tell people is real estate investing is real estate investing. If you're good at investing at something for $250 million, the same fundamentals apply to something that's $250,000. There's really no difference between the fundamentals. So some other ways that people can invest in real estate, I'll talk about a very popular one that has just come up in the last probably 12 or 18 months, and that's fractional ownership of real estate. And it's different than a REIT, where a REIT, you do not own a piece of the properties. You own a piece of the company that owns the properties, if that makes sense.
Okay.
A number of companies have come out recently where you actually own a fractional piece of a real estate. So let's say a single family home. And these have sprung up, especially during the COVID era, with people investing in different type of stocks and different structures. And these companies are getting a lot of visibility right now, especially with younger generation, people that are, say, younger than 30, who are looking to own real estate but don't have enough for 20% down payment. So they say, well, great, here's a place where I can invest fractional ownership into a property and still own a piece of it.
Pause right there. So that really the difference is in a REIT, you're buying a share of a company that the company then owns the property, but you don't own the property directly. Are you saying with this fractional ownership structure, you actually own a fraction of that property? Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right. Yep. So how it works is, let's say Steveco is this new tech startup. You go buy a single family home for $250,000. You then sell a fractional piece of that ownership to 1,000 different investors who put up, you know, anywhere from $500 up to $5,000. But it's very small check sizes from kind of the everyday younger investor pool. Hmm. I would say do not invest in those companies. That is probably one of the worst ways that someone can invest in real estate today. I was just looking at one of their offerings for one of my friends who was interested in this, and I was looking at their offering. And on top of the purchase price, let's say it's a $300,000 home. On top of the purchase price, that company is charging a 1% brokerage fee, 1% acquisition fee, a 2% offering fee, and a 4.5% sourcing fee.
Wow.
So on a $300,000 home, there's 8.5% on top of that that they're just charging to the investor. Hmm. And then they charge 1% asset management fee. Then when they sell the property, they charge a 6% fee on the disposition. I mean, they are just taking money right and left in terms of fees. And at the end of the day, you'd be much better investing in a diversified REIT than a fractional ownership of a single home where the fees are so high. So I would strongly encourage people stay away from that structure.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because your returns could definitely be gobbled up by all these back-end fees.
Yeah, the property needs to appreciate by 8.5% just for you to break even on your original investment.
Interesting.
And if you look at today's market, who knows where property values are going to go in the near term. So those are sort of the easiest, simplest ways to invest in real estate. It's a REIT, which I strongly encourage for people who are just looking to dip their toes, diversify their portfolio, don't want to get their hands dirty in real estate. Fractional ownership is also very easy. I strongly encourage people to stay away from that just because of the fee structure. The next level up would be owning your own rental property. This is something that you and I both do. We have a number of rental properties, and it definitely takes a little bit of time to build up to owning a rental property. For a rental property, unlike your primary home, you need at least a 20% down payment.
Mm-hmm.
So that right there can keep a lot of people from investing in a single family home or a townhome or a condo. It's just because they need to come up with a 20% down payment. But there are lots of benefits of having that single property or the townhome or the condo, which we can talk about in a little bit. But there's still some risk there because house pricing can go down. You can have a huge flood happen to your house, like in Florida with all these homeowners, hurricane, different things that could happen that could really eat away at your returns. But it's still a relatively safe investment.
Yeah. So let's dive into that a little bit more. I mean, you're starting to talk about some of the pros. I mean, so what are the pros of real estate investing then? Dive deeper into that.
Yeah. So I would say the biggest is home appreciation. In general, over the long term, house pricing has gone up over time. There have been dips, like in 2008 when house pricing dropped by 20-25%. So there are definitely times when it drops, but in the long term, pricing has always gone up, similar to the stock market. Sure, there are times when there's some type of recession or depression and the stock market goes down. But if you look at it over the long term, the trend is upward.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same with the real estate. That trend over time has been up, although there have been times when prices... Now, there are some markets in the U.S. where prices have just gone down and they never go up. But if you're smart about where you're investing, then the pricing over time should go up. So one of the benefits is definitely going to be the appreciation over time. You know, if you think about a $300,000 home and let's say on average that house went up by 2% a year, you're looking at $6,000 of appreciation every single year. That can more than cover the cost of actually owning that rental property.
Sure.
So the appreciation, that's definitely a big benefit. You can also offset your rental income with depreciation on the house, which is great. You can save some money there. You might need to pay for that on the back end, but kind of on a current basis, you can offset your rental income with depreciation and essentially pay zero taxes for years on your rental property, which is great. It can provide a good steady cash flow. You know, if you buy it right and you are able to lease it and keep it occupied, it can provide good income. It's not going to make you fabulously rich off this income, but you know, I typically tell people you should be looking for about a 4 to 6% yield on your cash on a yearly basis. That's a good kind of rule of thumb. So if you're getting that's great. Plus you have the appreciation on top of that, which is great.
Sure.
And one of the best benefits of owning real estate, and then we can start to go into some of the risks of owning your own properties, is you're able to use leverage. And this is very unique within real estate investing. With your stock portfolio, you can technically leverage your stock portfolio, but highly strongly don't recommend people leverage their stock portfolio. You saw people just get completely wiped out over the last few months by leveraging their stock portfolio. It's very speculative. Your loss and downside can be infinite, which is with a home, you're able to leverage. If you bought a $300,000 home, you only need $60,000 to buy that home, and the rest can be in the form of a mortgage, which, assuming you're able to get a good rate, usually that mortgage rate is going to be so low or so favorable that over time it is going to be very beneficial to you. So those are sort of the benefits of owning a rental property. Now, it comes with a lot of caveats that if you want me to, I can go into sort of the downside of owning your own real estate as well.
Yeah, let's introduce some of the cons to real estate investing as well.
I'll start with your own rental property. One of the cons is it's not passive income. When people say, oh, rental property is passive income, it's not. It takes a lot of work, and you have bad tenants and good tenants, and you have water heaters that go out, and you have squirrels that get into your rental property and tear the whole place apart.
That's a little PTSD for me. A squirrel climbed down the chimney and went crazy on my rental property. That's a true story.
That is a true story. So it's definitely not passive, and you can hire a property manager manage your property, but property managers are pretty expensive. You know, they can be anywhere from 6 to 10% of your rental income can be paid to a property manager, which can be a lot. So it's definitely not passive income, and it can be a lot of work, especially when things go wrong. When things go right, it's great. When things go wrong, it's not so great. So it can be a lot of work. It can be a lot of extra costs. You might not know when a water heater is going to break or a flood's going to happen. It can be some big out-of-pocket expenses. So, you know, if you ever buy a rental property, just make sure you have a good cash cushion set aside to be able to pay for any unforeseen things that crop up with it. But the positive is, over time, with the appreciation of the house and your tenant paying down the mortgage for you, it more than offsets the cost of owning and operating the real estate. So over time, it should be a great wealth generator for you, as long as you look at it as a long-term investment and not a short-term 2 to 3 year hold. But you should really buy a rental property with a 10 plus year horizon and not a very short-term 3 to 5 year horizon. Otherwise, you'll most likely come out break even or possibly losing money.
Got it. Because I mean, realistically, what's been going on in the last few years, as far as like record low interest rates combined with massive appreciation of real estate, I mean, that's really an anomaly. So you can't go into it thinking that every year is going to be, you know, 2020 when it comes to real estate investing.
Let's take a quick break.
All right. I have to interrupt the show, but I'll be super quick. have a question for you. Who are you working for? Chances are you're working for everyone else besides yourself. Think about it. You're working for shareholders by grinding away in someone else's company. You're working for a bank by paying interest. You're working for the government by paying taxes. You're working for social media companies by giving your attention to their paid advertisers. You're working for your friends by doing crap that you don't want to do. You're working for everyone else by not pursuing the most essential things you are destined to achieve. Look, I've been there. I'm still there at times. Ugh, it could be so frustrating. If you want to achieve financial freedom, the fastest way to do it is through business. Don't get tricked by get-rich-quick schemes. Don't be fooled that your 401k is going to build you wealth. Don't waste time by trying to piece business finance together. Check this out. Here's my invitation. Go to BYFIQ.com, which stands for Boosting Your Financial IQ.com, and check out our programs. We have one for every possible path you're on. Whether your goal is to become fluent in business finance, launch a profitable business, or scale a business successfully, we have a solution to help you. I promise you, your life will change when you take action. So check out these opportunities that I've prepared for you. Now back to the show.
That's exactly right. And, you know, if interest rates, I believe interest rates will come down, but I think they have to come down because not many people can afford a 7%+ mortgage right now. And so I do believe interest rates will drop, but even if they settle around 4-5%, those are still favorable rates where you can still make decent return on your investment property.
Sure.
And with that, one thing I think where people get into trouble with real estate, they think it's this massive boom to their portfolio where it's just going to supercharge their returns. They're going to make boatload of money, retire billionaires from their, you know, few rental properties that they own. But really, if you know, you should probably expect about a 8-12% return on your investment. Your IRR should be about a 8-12%, and that's pretty decent. That's pretty good. It diversifies your portfolio. If you're looking for just a 8-12% return, and those are your expectations, then you won't be disappointed. And that's kind of been the historical return that you should expect on real estate investment. Different if you're doing more speculative, like flipping a house, but that's a different category.
Which goes back to the Rule 72 that I've talked about on other podcast episodes where, you know, the Rule of 72 basically determines how long an investment will take to double given a fixed annual rate. So if you take 72 and divide it by like a 6% return, you're saying in 12 years, that return will double. But it's also, it's a 6% return, but you also have other factors like you were talking about where you can apply leverage, you have appreciation, you have tax benefits, and all those things go into the return as well. So just keep that in mind. But let me ask you this, Nate. With real estate, how is it considered a hedge against inflation? Because inflation is like piping hot right now, and people have been talking about real estate as this hedge. Can you explain that a little bit more in detail?
Sure. So I'll give you two different examples of the company I'm at right now and the company I was at before this. So the company I was at before this, we invested mostly in industrial real estate and life science real estate. With industrial, I'll use industrial as the example. A lot of those leases are for 10 or maybe even 15, 20 years. So you sign up Amazon for your warehouse, they pay a certain rate. And within the lease, you're able to raise rent about 1.5% to maybe 2% every single year over a 10 to 15 year period. Mm-hmm. So that's the most you can recoup from that tenant is a 2% increase each year. Now, you're also banking on appreciation, just like residential real estate. It's the same thing. You're banking on appreciation and paying down the mortgage and getting more equity in the deal, but that's the most you can charge. So if expenses run wild one year, expenses go up by 9% like inflation has been doing, you can't really recoup that by only being able to increase rent by 2%. So your cash flow gets eroded in that situation. Now, the company I'm at right now, we primarily focus on multifamily real estate. So those are large apartment buildings. Now, anyone who's rented, which is probably everyone listening to the podcast, you know that your lease is for 1 year. It's year to year to year. That means that the owner, the landlord is able to adjust the rent on a yearly basis. So across our portfolio at my company now, we were able to increase our rents by 16% across the portfolio over a one-year period.
Wow.
Now, if we were locked into a fixed lease over a 10-year period, it would have only been 2%, and our returns would have been eroded by that inflation. So we've actually been able to outpace inflation with our rental, which that's not the normal. Usually, it's only like 3% a year, and it kind of keeps pace with inflation. But in this case, we're actually able to increase rents. So if you own a rental property, you will be able to do the same thing. You are able to increase rents to match inflation, and you can kind of play with that a little bit better. And also, usually house pricing goes up in an inflationary environment. If you also think about interest rates, if you got into a loan that has a 3.5% mortgage, which is not happening anymore, and inflation was at 9%, that means your effective interest rate is actually negative. All of that can be countercyclical to inflation. It can be a hedge against inflation. The downside, obviously, is your expenses are also increasing. Usually, you can make up for it by the increases in.
Yeah, and that makes sense. And that's a great explanation. And that's the interesting thing, too, about leverage is what you alluded to. If you think about it and you say, okay, look, my mortgage is $2,000 a month, and that mortgage is fixed for whatever period that you choose to fix it at. So say it's a 30-year mortgage is fixed at $2,000 a month. It doesn't matter what goes on out there in the market with inflation. You know, groceries could go up, gas could go up, wages can go up, but it's still $2,000 a month. So in year 10, if inflation continues to climb steep, you know, $2,000 relative to what you're earning could be a much smaller percentage. And so that's another way that debt or leverage can be eroded away with inflation. And, you know, that could be another way to maximize returns.
Yep, absolutely.
So let's talk about returns and this term cap rate. So what is a cap rate and how is it calculated?
So cap rate, that is probably one of the most widely used terms in the real estate investment world. And what the cap rate is, well, actually, before I talk about cap rate, let me take a step back and explain a couple different components of cap rate. So let me first talk about net operating income.
Okay.
And then I'll get back to cap rate. So net operating income, or NOI, it's essentially the EBITDA of your property. So if you take your rental revenue, and this is true for whether it's a single family home or a huge portfolio, you take the rental revenue minus the operating expenses of the property, and that gets you to your NOI. It's your EBITDA if you want to translate it into the corporate world. So the NOI, we can then compare that to the purchase price, and it basically tells us what our year one expected yield would be if we had no leverage on the property. So cap rate is just looking at the NOI divided by the property's purchase price.
Okay.
So if you bought a property for $1 million and it produced $100,000 of NOI in that first year, that means the cap rate would be 10%.
Got it.
I
think it's an important distinction what you said with NOI, because, you know, I've heard people loosely throw around terms and they say, yeah, you know, my property, you know, I cash flow $24,000 a year. $2,000 is what I charge a month, and times 12 months is $24,000. And it's like, that's not your NOI. You have to deduct the expenses. So thanks for clarifying that.
Yeah. When I hear people, there's a bunch of people on Instagram and TikTok, and they throw those numbers around of I'm cash flowing $100,000, $24,000 a year. It's very, very misleading. And you really need to take away all those expenses, and that gets you to your NOI. And then if you really want to know what your yield is going to be on your cash, you then need to subtract out your debt payment and taxes and all of that. So, but NOI is looking at it from an unlevered perspective, assuming you had zero debt, what would be your yield on your cash that very first year?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's kind of funny, kind of a side note, but I don't know if you ever saw that documentary, I think is on Hulu, about WeWork, and Adam Newman and the WeWork team, I know that they had different ways of defining their profit. I can't remember what term they used, but it was like the WeWork profit metric. And basically it excluded things like rent and like marketing and other massive expenses. So it's just, you have to be careful with terminology and really understand what people are saying when they say NOI, cash flow, profit, because really, you know, it just goes back to like, you want to be talking apples to apples when you're measuring cap rates here.
Yeah. I actually saw, I think it was called like community EBITDA or something like that, but
yeah, community EBITDA.
I was just reading an article from Forbes or something the other day, and it said something like, oh, this 35-year-old makes $100,000 in passive income each year. Learn how. I was like, huh. I'll click on that clickbait article and open it. It's like, oh, yeah, this person owns 4 rental properties, and in total, the rental revenue is $100,000. Mm-hmm. Well, that's super misleading because, to your point, that person's not making $100,000 of passive income. Well, they are, but then once you took out all their expenses, what's their net income that they're receiving from those properties? So it can be very misleading. You got to be careful when you're looking at things.
So a cap rate range, which is realistic, I mean, because the market's obviously, I mean, it's going to, competition will erode away the cap rates, and appreciation values and so on and so forth will erode cap rates as well. But what's a good range or just a rule of thumb for most years?
I would say if you're looking at buying your own rental property, if you're anywhere, depending on the market, because if you're investing in a market like Boston, it's going to be much lower cap rate because the price is going to be so much higher than in a place like in Knoxville, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. But as a general rule, you know, if you're anywhere in the 5 to 8% cap rate range, you're most likely going to be able to make money from the property. You know, if you try to go too much higher than that, you're going to start to get into more speculative real estate, which I can talk a little bit more about that. But in any lower than that, that means you're most likely overpaying for the property, and that's also not a good investment.
Yeah, and good point, because some areas, I remember my first rental property was in Texas in the Dallas area, and home prices in Dallas at the time were really low. I mean, you could buy a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, single-family house for $100,000. And you could charge, you know, $1,500 a month in rent. So you take out the expenses and you could be at a cap rate of at least 10, right? 10%. But also the appreciation rate historically is a lot lower. But then you have other areas like you're alluding to with Boston, where you may have a lower cap rate, right? But you may enjoy higher appreciation. So, I mean, but there is a range. So it doesn't, so it maybe explain that a little bit more, because you know, if an investor is just going off cap rates, they may say, hey, look, I found this great place in rural Alabama. And in rural Alabama, I can find this property for $100,000 and my cap rate's 12%. But it's like, well, that property is probably going to be $100,000 for the next like 5 years, right?
Right. Yep. So think of cap rate. Cap rate really is an indicator of risk. And so if the lower the cap rate, should mean a lower risk property. And the higher the cap rate should mean a higher risk property. Not always, but that's a general rule of thumb. Mm-hmm. And so to your point, if you're investing in a property and it's a 12% cap rate, it's a 12% cap rate for some reason. Either it needs a bunch of work to it, so you need to put in $25,000, $50,000, $75,000 of renovation costs, which mm-hmm. then needs to be added to your purchase price to get you a true cap rate. Or it might be in a blighted area. It might be in a place that has population is decreasing rapidly and prices are dropping significantly. It can be in a high vacancy market. So you just got to look at the entire real estate investment. You have to look at the location, the demographics. It's much more than just here's a property has a high cap rate and property values always go up. And so this is a great investment. You have to be more careful about that.
Okay. So is it possible to time the market? I know with stocks, you know, so many people talk about timing the market and they have the next crystal ball that's going to tell you when the market drops. But in actuality, you know, the majority of market gains happen just in a few days of the entire calendar year. So trying to time the market when it comes to stocks is almost impossible. And I don't know if anybody's ever been able to do it successfully over the long term. Now, when it comes to real estate investing, is it possible to time the market? And what happens if someone buys at the top of the market? I mean, are they just like doomed? Like they make a terrible investment, or over time, does it work out with appreciation and inflation and, you know, in maximizing leverage and all that other stuff? What are your thoughts on timing?
So in terms of timing, the answer is just the same as the stock market. You can't time the market. There are times when it'll be more intelligent to buy than other times, but in the end, no one has that crystal ball to know exactly when, what's going to happen to pricing. I remember before COVID happened, this is late 2019, early 2020, within the real estate investment world, everyone was saying pricing has hit its peak. We are going to go into recession. Pricing has to fall out. This is just unsustainable. And everyone in the real estate investment world at the end of 2019 and January of 2020 was saying, we're at a peak. We can't go any higher than this. We're due for a recession. The pandemic hits, and all of a sudden, over the last 2.5, almost 3 years now, real estate has appreciated by 25-40% during that time. Mm-hmm. And so you just never know. It's impossible to really time it. Now, if there are some better times, you know, when everyone is selling or not buying, that could be a good opportunity to purchase real estate. So, you know, for me personally, I am potentially looking to buy rental property in the next, 3 to 4 months, because I think pricing is going to decrease a little bit more. I hope interest rates will go down a little bit more. And I think it could be a good time to buy real estate that has dropped a little bit in pricing from where it peaked a few months ago. But who knows if that will be a good investment or not. But that's just something that I'm looking at personally.
That's interesting. Go ahead. Keep going.
Oh yeah. Well, I was going to say, you know, if you do buy at the top of the market, you're definitely not screwed. Because once again, whenever you invest in real estate, let's just exclude buying a REIT or something like that. Let's just talk about buying actual rental property. If you look at a long-term view, you should be able to kind of quote unquote dig yourself out of that hole over time. So over time, the house should appreciate beyond that peak price, even if it takes 4, 5, 6 years. During that time, you're going to be getting rental income, you're going to be paying down your mortgage, you're going to be getting those tax benefits. So over time, you should be able to dig yourself out of that, and it should be a positive return on your investment as long as you take that longer term view.
Yeah. I think that's critical, that long term view, like you're saying.
Yeah. And that's where people get the most in trouble with real estate investing. It's taking that short term view. So back to your original question about different ways to invest in real estate. One popular method that people like to show on TV, these influencers on Instagram love to show this, it's flipping property. Mm-hmm. That one, it's extremely risky. You have to be willing to lose everything if you go that route, and put in a lot of time and effort and deal with upset stomach a lot, because that can either be really, really good or really, really bad for you.
You tear open a wall and all of a sudden you have asbestos or mold, and there goes your returns, right?
Absolutely. There are so many horror stories of people trying to do flips, and it just, either you lose money on it or you break even. It's not a rags to riches, bulletproof investment idea to do property flipping. It comes with a ton of risk, and you should only do it if you feel very comfortable taking those risks and you have capital to spare, that if you lost it, it doesn't completely blow up your entire retirement saving.
Sure.
So property flipping is not for the average person. I typically don't recommend it for most people unless you have good experience in that industry.
Well, okay. Well, let's talk about analyzing investments in real estate, because for you listeners out there, the biggest, nerdiest, best financial modeler I've ever come across is my brother. Seriously, if you could see him in Excel, he could build the sweetest financial model known to mankind. And so when it comes to finance, Nate, let me ask you this. How important is it to build a financial model when you're making these real estate investment decisions, do you need to do something sophisticated like that, where you're projecting out cash flows and you're trying to compute IRR and cap rates and everything else? Or is it more like intuitive than quantitative?
I would say for the average person, it's more intuitive. If you really want to nerd out on it, you can build a very complicated model, but luckily you can do it with a very simple analysis. So let me just start with investing in a REIT. Investing in a REIT, as long as you're investing in a REIT that has a large market cap, call it $1 billion or more, they have a solid dividend, they've been growing over the years, you don't need to do much more analysis than that to invest in a REIT. You don't need to build out financial models. I mean, that's way beyond most people's capabilities to really model out entire company and portfolio and everything else. So that's the easiest one. You don't really need to do any financial analysis beyond just kind of buying the stock and doing your research a little bit on that. For an actual real estate property that you want to buy, say a condo or a townhome or single family home, the analysis can actually be fairly straightforward. And what I usually do, I just do a back of the napkin analysis when I'm looking at a property. So I'll look at the purchase price. I get a loan calculator. You can get a loan calculator from Zillow, or you know, there's a thousand different places where you can find a loan calculator. You calculate what your monthly payment is going to be based on a 20% or more down payment. You look at the real estate taxes of the property, estimate insurance, build in a buffer for capital expenditures and various maintenance, and you figure out what your net operating income is going to be after paying all those expenses. And then you look at what your cash flow would be after paying your principal and interest on the debt. And after all of that, you should be coming out positive cash flow. Hopefully you're coming out with a, call it 4 to 6% or so cash return after paying all those expenses on your original equity investment. And if that's the case, then that's kind of the extent of your analysis you need to do. IRR will kind of fall out from property appreciating and everything else, but as long as your cash flowing is positive and you have a buffer in terms of cash to pay for any major expenses in a good market, then you don't really need to go too much beyond that in terms of investing. That's kind of one of the beauties of real estate investing. You don't need to be a financial genius to do it. You just need to be smart about where you buy and how you lease it.
No, I like it. And I like the simplicity in that advice, because, you know, my gut always tells me if something is so complicated, right? So complicated to understand, like I stay away from that. So I like how simple you explained it. And I don't think it has to be this huge analysis when investing in real estate. So you have a lot of experience in this space. So I'm going to end with this question. Do you have some successful strategies that will increase the odds of making money in real estate investing that you can share with the audience?
I would say for investing in your own personal property, the location really does matter more than anything. Everyone's heard the phrase location, location, location. It really is true, and that almost overcomes anything else at the property. It's a good location. You want to make sure you're in a location where there is good population increases, or at least populations remain steady. That's one of the big things. You want to be in a decent to good school district. So if you look on Zillow, or there's a company called niche.com, N-I-C-H-E.com, you can look up the scores of the surrounding elementary, middle, and high schools. And you kind of want to be at least a 5 or 6 or higher in those places. Think about it. You're running a property and you have a family, you're going to want to run a property where you have good schools so your kids can go to a better school district. So that's another key part. You want to make sure you are in a good part of town, you know, that that's safe and that people want to live in. And if you get those 4 things right, the rest of it should work out fairly well. Obviously, you want to make sure the house is in good condition. You want to make sure you do lots of inspections and full on hand to fix things that you need to have fixed. But really, the location is the biggest driver of how successful your real estate.
That's great. That's great advice. And I mean, this whole podcast has been littered with great advice. So thank you so much, Nate, for sharing your expertise in this space and giving us insight based on your experience. This has been a fabulous episode. And, you know, of course, I'm biased because you're my brother and I think you do amazing things. But thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it.
It's now time to give some shout outs. So thank you, everybody, for giving me your feedback. It's extremely helpful. This one's from Michael. Just wanted to reach out and say thank you for providing that podcast to all of us. As a college student studying finance, it's always great to wake up in the morning to start listening to this podcast. You have done inspiring stuff in your career, and providing the education and lessons to others illustrates your selflessness you carry. Well, thanks a lot. That really means a lot, Michael. This one's from Alex. My name is Alex. I'm a 24-year-old engineer from Switzerland. I'm an active listener of your Boosting Your Financial IQ podcast. I wanted to say that I really enjoy listening to your show, and I appreciate your expertise. Thanks a lot, Alex. That really means a lot. Thank you so much for giving me your feedback, and I'll continue to give shout-outs as the comments roll in. Hey, real quick, if you get value out of this podcast, it would mean the world to me if you would leave us a review. Also, if you want to be featured on the show, send me a recording with your name, your age, where you're from, and your question through a voice note or a video using your smartphone. Then email me the file at hello@byfiq.com. BYFIQ stands for Boosting Your Financial IQ. So once again, it's hello@byfiq.com. If selected, I'll give you a shout out and answer your question for you and the entire community. One last thing, if you want access to additional resources that will help you fast track your path to financial freedom, visit byfiq.com or download our free app in the Apple or Google Play App Store today. Thanks again. Hey, real quick, if you get value out of this podcast, it would mean the world to me if you would leave us a review. Also, if you want to be featured on the show, send me a recording with your name, your age, where you're from, and your question through a voice note or a video using your smartphone. Then email me the file at hello@byfiq.com. BYFIQ stands for Boosting Your Financial IQ. So once again, it's hello@byfiq.com. If selected, I'll give you a shout out and answer your question for you and the entire community. One last thing, if you want access to additional resources that will help you fast track your path to financial freedom, visit byfiq.com or download our free app in the Apple or Google Play App Store today. Thanks again.